program in living color on NBC.
Parades are as popular down on the farm as they are in the big city. Farmers, food packers, politicians, and leading citizens are celebrating the harvest, the gathering of the spring crop in the heart of Florida's farmland. Even though many farmers consider this year a disaster, they have shared in a harvest that brings Florida agriculture an income of over $1.4 billion each year. For the farm workers who pick the crops, the migrants, watching the parade from the sidelines, there is little to celebrate.
But the poor people like us, we just don't have a chance. We don't get good jobs. We have to pick fruit and different stuff. We have to take what we can get.
The only way you can get a job, you got to owe somebody. If they got anything for you to do, you can work like that, but you can pay them back. And I need something to do right now.
I might wear a pair of shoes for about 6 months and do without shoes in order for the kids to have something to wear at school. And that's only right.
The American people has become so used to easy living, they don't want to work anymore.
With an average annual income of $891, the migrants can hardly afford the basic necessities of life taken for granted by their fellow Americans. In the richest country in the world, the parade passes them by.
They are staying here for longer periods of time because the agricultural season has stretched out. They're here for 8 months, 9 months, some of them.
We was up in Michigan. We lived real good up there. We made good money until we came down here and we about starved to death. Come down here in Florida.
Migrant work is just worth it. Some people just come over and over and over, year after year. I don't know why. I wish I could go back to Texas. I'll never come back here to Florida because it's no job. It's not worth it.
Practically all of them are the happiest people that I've ever seen. They really enjoy what they're doing. They go from place to place, from crop to crop, and they really enjoy it.
Vegetables that every American eats are gathered by about 2.5 million people, farm workers, many of them migrant laborers who follow the crops from state to state. Florida, the Sunshine State, is the nation's leading supplier of citrus, its second largest source of fresh vegetables. Florida's farm industry depends on a migrant population of 200,000 men, women, and children. Because of its 8-month picking season, many of them choose to remain in Florida year-round, trying to put down roots, trying to live like other Americans. But they don't have the rights guaranteed the rest of us. In Florida and in many other states, migrants are not eligible for unemployment insurance. They are not guaranteed workman's compensation. They are not protected by age requirements in child labor laws. They are excluded from the protection given other workers in their attempts to organize or strike. And according to the United States Department of Labor, they work for an annual wage lower than that of any other income group in the country. And because of residency requirements, they are usually not qualified to vote. Though many of them no longer travel, they are still called migrants. despite some changes effected by federal and state agencies and local organizations, the migrants live in poverty and despair. This report examines their lives today, just 10 years after Edward R. Murrow first brought the migrant to the attention of the nation on the CBS Reports documentary, Harvest of Shame. These are the forgotten people, the underprotected, the undereducated, the underclothed, the underfed.
This is Belgrade, Florida. This is a shape-up for migrant workers. One farmer looked at this and said, "We used to own our slaves. Now we just rent them."
This is Belgrade, Florida today, 10 years after Harvest of Shame. Farm workers still gather each morning looking for a day's work in the fields. For a migrant, jobs are not always easy to find. Producer Martin Carr talked with migrants during the height of the picking season this past spring, when jobs seemed particularly scarce.
Have you been looking for work?
Sure.
What do you do?
Well, I just get out and go look for it.
Every day?
Yes.
And you haven't worked in a couple of months?
That's right. I don't like to sit around, you know. I like to work. If I know if I'm working, it's something for me and something for the family. Without a job, you ain't nowhere.
How many days a week do you find work now?
Well, I worked 3 days last week. I don't know how many I'll get next week.
Do you go out every day and look for work?
I try to.
How much did you make on a day?
$12.
$12. That means you made about $36 last week.
Right.
Are there weeks when your husband can't get work, Mrs. Garza?
Yes, sir. Like, it's been already for about 5 weeks.
Are there days when you go without food?
Sure, we do.
What do you do then?
I have to ask for it.
You have to go around to your neighbors?
Mm-hmm. I have to ask somebody, you know, that I don't have enough food. I need some food. And some days, well, I have to get some food for the kids, and my husband and I just have to wait.
Do you think you'll be able to get back to Texas?
I hope so. After school's out and the boys will start helping us again, we might get a couple of dollars, and then we can make the trip back home.
Have you ever thought of taking your boys out of school so that they could help your husband work in the field?
No, sir.
You want them to finish school?
I want them to finish the school. I'll try the best to educate them as much as I can so they won't have to be working like we are. Because they need to learn how to read and write and talk good English and speak good English so they can get a better job. Because if they don't go to school, they'll never have a better job than what we're doing right now. They'll be a migrant all their lives. And I don't want them to be that.
Now, you can't hardly make enough to go from one season to another. Now.
On the average week, how much money have you been making?
About $20 a week.
About $20 a week. Is this you yourself?
That's me and my wife.
You and your wife working?
That's right.
And you're making $20 a week?
That's right.
How much rent are you paying?
$16 a week.
Well, that only leaves you $4 a week.
That's right. To get groceries. You can't get no groceries $4 a week. So we just have to do the best we can.
You have six children.
Six children and a wife.
What do you do on a week when you have only $4?
Well, I take up, I bar, I do anything I can to live, you know. Except steal, I don't steal nothing. And so we just survive, try to get by until we do good work and make something.
On the weeks when you make nothing, is it because you don't want to work?
No, it's because I can't work.
Why can't you work?
Well, you can't, you can't get a bus going out, or probably a bus going out and the guy you're riding with, he ain't got nothing. He's off for a day or two, and he just can't work.
Farmer K.D. Eatman claims he has jobs that go begging. He doesn't take the migrants at their word.
I would like to be able to prove to you that they didn't want work by going and trying to pick them up and bring them here and saying, "All right, let's pick these beans and see how many of them would really work." They will not work. They make out like they want to work, but they don't want to.
The migrant who does find work in the fields is actually earning less in terms of real money than he was 10 years ago. While other workers' annual wages have gone up, His have stayed the same. And inflation has taken its toll. According to the United States Department of Labor, the average individual migrant last year earned $891. A family of four earned $2,700, $900 below the official poverty level of the United States. Migrants are specifically excluded from the minimum wage rate that applies to most of us. For them, the minimum wage is $1.30. Less than the hourly wage guaranteed workers imported from the West Indies to cut sugar cane in Florida fields. For most farm workers, however, it makes little difference what the minimum wage is, for they are paid not by the hour, but by the piece. Paid for what they pick, not for the time it takes them to pick it. Farmers claim that piecework means more money for the worker. For all but the youngest and strongest, however, it means less. The day NBC News visited this bean field, the piece rate was $1 a bushel, paid in cash as each bushel basket was filled. By the end of the 8-hour day, most workers had picked just 7 or 8 bushels. That is, they earn $7 or $8, far below the minimum wage. Florida growers claim they cannot afford to pay higher wages, but higher wages would mean higher prices for the consumer. Yet, the United States Department of Labor estimates that if the wages paid to farm workers were doubled, and all of the increase passed on to the American housewife, she would pay just 1 or 2 pennies more for a head of lettuce, a dozen oranges, a bunch of radishes, or 2 pounds of celery. Perhaps the migrant, with his low wage scale, is subsidizing both farmer and consumer. Celery cutters are paid by the roll. They are expected to cut 6,000 stalks of celery a day, feeding them into a machine known as a mule train. A tractor has replaced the mules, but the migrant still supplies the stoop labor, bending over 600 times every hour in the usual 10-hour day. On a good day, he may earn $22 here at the Belglade farm of America's largest celery grower, A. Duda and Sons. The Duda family grows 23 varieties of fruit and vegetables, some of which they can and market under their own labels. They farm nearly 100,000 acres in Florida, plus a 2.75 million acre ranch in Australia. President Andrew Duda spoke about the problems of running this vast agricultural empire.
Mr. Duda, would it be fair to describe you as one of the largest growers in Florida?
I think so.
On an annual basis, how much money do you have to take in to break even?
We gross about 20 million. Last year, we paid for the privilege of farming. We lost over $400,000. Every person in the organization, including the migrant worker, made more money than I did because we lost. There was one while we had 5 years of red ink and running, 5 years. 1 year we lost $1 million. And that's when the farmers were going broke, particularly cereal growers. And that's when we finally stopped being rugged individualists and decided we better get together because the chain stores had a tremendous buying power. And we as unorganized growers were just being hurt. So this was the condition we were faced with. So we formed, got a marketing order, first a state marketing order, then a celery exchange, and then we had to go to a federal marketing order in order to have enough, as much bargaining power as the chain stores got buying power. And once we did this, it works beautifully.
And other words, the growers got together to agree on what price to sell to the supermarket.
Exactly.
Mr. Duda, do you think it would be a good idea if farm labor were to organize as well?
No, because in perishables, a week, say a farmer, particularly various crops, farmers go on strike, they ruin the farmer real fast.
You say that the big threat to you would be the strike. You deal in perishables, and if a strike occurred, you would be at the mercy of the people working. Where farm labor has been organized, the unions have agreed to a no-strike clause. Wouldn't that solve the problem?
If anyone would say that the people guarantee they won't strike, I don't think it's worth the papers written on. Years ago, when we, our darkies, as we used to call them in those days, you pointed out to them, here's the situation, here's what we're doing, here's what we're paying you, here's what we're getting, here's what it costs us. We're losing money on what you're harvesting. And when you first point us out to them, they would continue to work. But you take that, you take the same people now, the young people, you tell them the same thing, they'll laugh at you. And the Negro in particular. The Negro are fine people, but they have to respect you. You get down to their level and they have no respect to you. I mean, if you want to be down and act like a Negro and be dirty and whatnot, they're not going to respect you.
Florida depends on the labor of the migrant, 55% of whom are Negroes. Driven there when machines replaced them in the cotton fields of the old South. Another 35% are Mexican Americans who migrated from Texas. Unlike the tourists visiting Florida's Gold Coast, these new arrivals are often unwelcome guests. And racism must be added to the list of problems the migrant faces everywhere he turns in the state. To most Americans, Florida is Miami, or the more exclusive Palm Beach, the richest township not only in Florida, but in the entire United States. Its main street is certainly the most elegant and possibly the most expensive shopping center in America. Palm Beach homes are modern-day palaces, occupied a few months a year by migrants of a different sort, the affluent who fly here to escape the cold, probably unaware that less than 10 miles away live the poorest people in America. Crowded into homes that are not required to meet the legal standard applied to Florida's urban slums. Even with standards this low, more than 100 migrant camps operated without licenses last year. This year, the Florida State Board of Health did not collect statistics on unlicensed camps. Davis Camp, just outside Pahokee, is owned by a local house mover. The homes in Davis Camp do not meet the minimum standards. They have been condemned for a year. These are some of Mr. Davis's houses. We cannot film them all, for on the day NBC News visited the camp, guaranteed free access by Florida law, landlord Davis ordered us off his property at the point of a gun.
Well, no sense in that.
Why don't you want
me
to
see
you, Todd? Just because I've told you no, and that means no. Are these your homes?
Yes, sir. These are mine. I live
here. Is there anybody I can talk to make arrangements?
Don't be nasty, of course.
Is there anybody I can talk to make arrangements to come out here?
No.
Not inside this border,
Jay.
Why?
Because you didn't contact me first.
Most other camp owners did not desire to let NBC document conditions in their camps, and our production crew found itself repeatedly harassed.
Why don't you want me to see inside?
Just because I've told you no.
Conditions in the migrant housing camps in Florida, owned and rented by public agencies, are often no better.
Why
Everglades Camp, here in Pahokee, was built more than 30 years ago as temporary housing for farm workers. 8 years ago, this camp, along with two others operated by the Public Housing Authority, was condemned by the Palm Beach County health officials. But 8 years later, 8 years after the condemnation, it's still here, still open.
How is it that a
house... Producer Carr asked the head of the Pahokee Housing Authority, James W. Vann, why condemned public housing remains occupied.
Well, because there was no place else for the people to go. It's a commentary on the stringency of the general housing condition in this area. That it boils down simply to this, sir, that four walls and a roof, regardless of how poor, are better than the great outdoors. And we are, as you see, in construction on a new housing project here, which is referred to as Paget Island Homes, 200 units. And we are starting construction at this time on Framed Village, also 200 units.
Some 12,000 units of low-cost housing are now open or getting underway in areas throughout Florida where migrants are concentrated. The Pahokee Housing Authority will operate 515 units, with rents adjusted to meet the income of the tenants. The new projects will be a boon to the families lucky enough to move in. But as Director Vann acknowledges, there is a serious flaw in the program.
We do not have a program that is geared to the needs of the migrant. And this is one of the areas which has been, in my opinion, sadly neglected in the matter of a housing program in this country. If I were going to build housing strictly for the migrant segment of the population, I would figure on keeping it closed at least 60 days of the year and probably 90 days. Now, if you eliminate any rental income for 25% of the year and keep the rents for the remaining 75% of the year within the reach of your migrant agricultural worker, you come up empty when you start looking for enough money to operate it. It just simply is economically impossible.
Would a migrant family be able to live in a project like this?
Unfortunately, you put your finger on one of the bad points with a program of this kind. We cannot turn away permanent residents in the low-income group in order to hold this housing for a migrant. The migrant is, has always been, and undoubtedly will continue to be, just by the sheer economics of the situation, the low man on the totem pole when it comes to housing.
The number of new public housing units doesn't begin to meet existing needs. Migrants continue to rent from private landlords, often paying as much as $80 a month. These houses are commonly called quarters, probably a holdover from the days of slavery. Armstrong Quarters in the center of Pahokee slum is owned and operated by Dr. L.W. Armstrong, a retired dentist, and his wife.
Mrs. Armstrong, are these your homes here?
Yes, they are.
How did you come to own them?
Oh, we've had them many years, 20 or so.
You've had them 20 or so years?
Mm-hmm.
Why did you buy them to begin with?
Well, just as an investment.
Mrs. Brown, you live in Armstrong Quarters, don't you?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
How much is your monthly rent?
I pay $42.50 for rent.
What kind of a house do you rent?
Yes, that old wooden house in Armstrong Quarters behind the bath, too.
Does it have any running water inside?
Mm-mm. Outside, everything. You got to go outdoors for everything.
Is the house in good condition?
No, sir. It ain't in good condition.
What are the problems?
It's raggy and when you walk, it just shakes. And it just ain't no good.
Is there anybody that ever comes over and inspects your house?
The state health and the welfare and the city, they come.
And have all your houses, the frame houses included, passed inspection?
Yes, they have.
What are the standards for housing here?
Well, for a standard house, you have to have running water inside and sink and toilet and bath.
And do all your frame houses have this?
No, they don't. They're not. They're substandard. But
they're substandard.
Yes.
And in other words, if you fall below the building code, it doesn't make any difference. You can still rent the house.
Well, you couldn't rent something that was just newly built that way, but something that is has long been in operation, why, you can. But when one of our houses gets burned or something, why, we do put a standard house in.
You put a standard house in.
What's it like living here in Armstrong quarters?
Well, it's kind of rough, but it's the best we can do.
Do you have any water inside?
No. You have to walk down the trail and get it.
The pump, huh?
I can speak it.
What about the toilet? Toilets outside, too?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. And they be nasty all the time, and that's where all the water be running, because they be running over all the time, but she charged us for the water.
Any rats?
Not too many rats, but a whole gang of roaches. A whole gang of them.
They're kind of slack. You just have to, that's our biggest problem, is to see that they keep cleaned up around and keep their toilet scrubbed.
How do you manage to do that?
Well, we have inspection. I do that personally.
The only way she come through the spiky quarters, when she hear tell us some of y'all coming in to check the quarters, and then she'll come in then like that.
Is there a housing shortage in Pahokee?
Yes, there has been.
So in other words, there's really not very much choice for a family. If they wanted to move, there's no place to move, really.
No, there's not. There hasn't been. And I think for some time to come, it's going to be that way.
Dr. Armstrong come over here this morning when I was out there washing. And he come to me, he said, didn't you told them folks yesterday but my house ain't no good?
What folks did he mean when he...
Yo, see, you mean yo out there yesterday.
Uh-huh.
Met y'all. And I told him, I said, you can look up there now and you can tell the house ain't no good yourself. And he said, if the house ain't no good, you just move out. Move.
And what are you going to do, Mrs. Brown?
I'm just going to stay there until I get me somewhere to go. That's all. I ain't got nowhere to go.
Save you time, money, and trouble. Now, look at the new words you will meet in this lesson. Say the words to yourself as I read them. Antidote.
These high school students struggling to read are exceptional.
Was dad because...
Dad, just dad.
Most migrant children never get this far.
War dad.
Oh,
what you say now? 80% of migrant children never enter a high school classroom. More than half don't even get to the seventh grade. The few who do are pitifully far behind, despite streamlined remedial reading programs and dedicated teachers like Sally Carey of Belglade High School.
So that's her name, not Morla.
Morla.
Right, say it again.
Morla.
No.
Morley.
Mrs. Carey explained why her students continue to fail.
How old are these students?
12 to around 19 or 20.
Isn't 19 or 20 a little bit old to be learning to read?
Yes, but they've never learned it before, so they have to learn. And the classes, they haven't had the individual attention that they need in a lab, so they haven't been able to learn to read.
Are many of these boys and girls the sons and daughters of migrant families that travel?
Oh, yes. Most of them. In fact, there's a great many of them go up the road with their family. They may not go up the road this year, but the next year they'll be up in New York or New Jersey part of the year.
How does this affect their schooling?
And it takes the child a while to adjust to a classroom situation, to get to know the teacher and what she wants. And they have to do this off and on throughout the year and without any, you know, stable home to come home to. It's more difficult to adjust.
Do any of them ever talk to you about these problems?
They just don't like to talk about it. They don't like to be known as migrants. They don't like you to ask them if their families work in the fields. They don't.
Why is that?
Well, they're embarrassed about it. There's some stigma attached to being a field worker, I think.
What do you think will become of your students after they leave school?
Work in the fields.
They have been working in the fields from the time they were old enough to do the job, if only for a few days a week. No child labor law sets a minimum age for young farm workers in Florida. Children are supposed to be in school during school hours, but few people check. The United States Senate Subcommittee on Migratory Labor estimates that 800,000 children under 16 work as hired farmhands across the nation. Almost half of them between the ages of 10 and 13.
Do you have any children, ma'am?
Five.
You have five children.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be able to keep them in school, you think, till the end of the year?
Well, we try.
You try?
Yeah, sometimes we take them out to help us pick beans, you know, help us along.
How old are they?
My oldest boy is 9.
How old are the other boys?
One 8, one 7, 6. And the baby, she's 5.
And you keep them out of school to help you in the field?
Yeah.
That's so you can make a little bit more money?
Yeah.
Are they good when they pick in the field?
Well, they do their best, you know.
Look, there is a picture of a migrant worker. They call them migrants, they're natives. And a child in the bean field. Look how terrible this is. And a mother and child were a picture of perfect health. And we asked, what's the matter with it? The child is in the open, fresh air. It's with its mother. What's wrong with it?
Tell me about it. Tell me about what you have inside there.
This year, Florida received over $7 million in federal funds to educate migrant children. But the parents of most of these students dropped out before the seventh grade, and their children, according to a Florida survey, will do exactly the same.
We don't work.
You don't work when you go to Texas? What do you do when you go to Texas?
Dr. Donald Stone, director of the Collier County Migrant Education Program, explains why education alone cannot break the cycle.
About what period of time, how many months does a migrant child attend school here in Collier County?
I would say somewhere between 4 to 7 months out of the 10-month program. For the most part, these children do not attend school other than that. This is all they get in a year, and in some years they do not attend our school when they're here in the wintertime for the winter crop season because they're needed to harvest the crops. The family wants the income that the child can produce. They must live day to day because that is the nature of their life. The family, for example, when it works in a field, is paid daily for what it does, not at the end of a week. And the child consequently grows up and enters school with the notion that if he does something right, he must be rewarded instantly. A person, for example, with an ambition to go to college is, in a sense, postponing an immediate reward in terms of money that he can get on a job if he were to quit school at any point for what he hopes will be a better job much further down the road. And if we can communicate this notion to the family, fine, but we're having this problem of breaking into that family circle.
What chances do you think a student has now to escape from the migrant situation?
Frankly, I think it would take 3 to 4 generations. The migrant child, for the most part, has a rather negative self-concept of himself and his own abilities, and doesn't have too great an expectation that he can ever be anything other than what his family, his mother and father are, or than what he's doing.
If you were working in the orange grove, you weren't able to go to school, were you?
No. I quit school.
You quit school? How come?
I don't like school, that's
all. Why?
Getting too many fights and getting too much trouble when you go to school.
You're 15 years old now, right?
Mm-hmm.
What class were you in?
I was in the 8th.
You were in the 8th grade?
Huh.
Before, your mother was telling me that sometimes it was a problem having enough clothes or even shoes to get to school. Has that ever been a problem for you?
Yeah. It's been a problem lots of times.
Ever been a time when you haven't had the clothes to put on or the shoes to put on? You had to go bare feet?
Mm-hmm.
The other kids ever say anything?
Yeah, they make fun of you.
They make fun of you.
Uh-huh.
And what does it feel like when you aren't wearing shoes or aren't wearing the right clothes and the other kids are making fun of you?
It just makes you feel different. So.
Is that why you left school?
Uh-huh. Wouldn't go back to nothing either.
Why?
Just don't like school.
How about lunches at school? Do you get lunch at school?
Mm-hmm.
You have to buy it?
Yeah.
Do you always have the money to pay for it?
No. Sometimes we'd have to charge it.
Do you ever have to not eat and watch the other kids eat?
Yeah. Did that a lot of times, too.
What does that feel like, Jackson?
Well, they've got something better than you. It makes you feel like a bum. I guess it's 1 a.m. anyhow.
You think you're a bum?
Yeah.
Why? Why, Jackson?
I don't have the things other people have.
Palm Beach in Miami, it is oranges. Two-thirds of the oranges grown in the United States are Florida oranges, from groves like this one, which happens to belong to Minute Maid. Florida farm workers each year harvest a citrus crop worth $400 million to the growers. That translates into more than 25 billion oranges each year. Virtually every one of them picked by hand. Florida orange pickers, like other migrants, are usually paid a piece rate based on how many boxes they fill. This past season, the going piece rate was 35 cents a box. Even during the height of the season, there are days when there is no work. The weather is bad, the fruit isn't ready, or the processing plants are overloaded. A worker who might have been making $25 on a good day finds himself with days at a time, or weeks at a time, when he can't make a dime. That is why, when work is available, entire families go into the groves.
Mrs. Farmer, how many children do you have?
Five.
And how about when you were pregnant? Did you have to work then?
Sure.
While you were pregnant?
Yeah.
About how far along?
One time until about, I guess, 2 weeks before the baby was born. But then, you know, if you got kids, they got to eat and got to have a place to live, so you automatically do what you wouldn't do if you didn't have them.
The two of you go out and work.
Well, we can make it better when both of us are working, and by myself, I can't make it. I don't make enough money.
What do you do when you're by yourself, say, in a day? How much money?
Approximately $10. It's hard to say because you may get in a grove that has good fruit, and you may get one that you can't make nothing out of.
Do you ever know in advance how much work you're going to have?
No, sir. We might be told today to be ready in the morning, and in the morning they may tell us, forget it. We have it rough. We do have it rough, but we work. And fruit picking is the hardest work. I mean, it's harder than construction work or any work that I know.
But do you think you'll get caught in it? Do you want to get out of it?
Yes, I want to get out of it, but I don't know how.
Why is it that you're not working right now?
Well, the trees are too tall and I can't handle the ladder by myself. That's the reason.
Why do you have to handle the ladder by yourself? Can't your husband help you?
He's not here.
Who is working to support the family?
Well, I worked 2 days, but that's all by myself. And they said that I couldn't clean the trees good because that had to go up on the ladder. And I couldn't do it. By myself.
In those 2 days, how much money did you make?
Well, my son and me made, my son worked with me too, and we made $32.
You made $32 for the 2 days?
Mm-hmm.
On a good week, what do you make?
Well, sometime I'll make high as 50, maybe 60.
Not a good week.
That's a good week for me.
Right. And how many people are you supporting here out of that?
Well, just I and my daughter, four kids.
Are you worried about the future?
Sure I am. But now I don't see no future, I'm but hard work, and I mean, I don't never save anything.
Can't get ahead.
No, never get ahead.
What do you think of this house?
Well, I just think it's terrible. It's not enough room for larger families. This. And these houses are just too small. It's all right for maybe just a husband and wife. But when they come around to maybe 7 or 8, or maybe 10 people in the house, it's just too many, isn't it?
You have 8 people in this house.
That's right.
You lived here for a long time?
Mm-hmm.
How long?
12 years.
12 years.
Who owns these homes, I was told, are owned by the Coca-Cola company. Coca-Cola is at work on a major plan, which it claims will correct the failings it has found in its citrus operation.
Say you're in charge?
Yes, sir.
And who did you say give you permission?
Are we trespassing?
Yeah.
Why?
Because this is a Coca-Cola food property.
Uh-huh.
If you got business here, it's fine. But you got to make it okay with our department.
Right. In other words, we can't talk to the lady or anything like that.
You got, if you don't have permission, I suggest you leave till you get permission. They'd like to know about it.
Okay. You know, the only reason I'm asking is that we were...
We'd be glad to help you if you tell us what you want and what you're after and all. But we don't just have people just dropping in and taking over till we know what they're doing, see?
Well, let me ask you a question. How do you visit somebody at their home? I mean, this is their home, right?
No argument. Let me call Joe.
I'm just trying to finish our interview.
Let me see if he wants you to move or not now.
I think that we should leave. I don't want you to feel that you're going to get into trouble. Okay.
Ask him a question. Well, I know all I can do is tell you the best of my hands. That's all. I mean, so far as...
Good. Well, we did beautifully and we talked.
Sure.
Thank you.
Coca-Cola provides 89 individual housing units rent-free to families who work in its groves. In its 3 labor camps, Coke has dormitories for 400 single men who migrate to Florida for the citrus season. Coca-Cola Foods, using the brand names Minute Maid, Snowcrop, and Hi-C, is the largest single grower and processor of oranges in the world. The oranges, they don't grow themselves, they have to buy. A total of about 350 million a year. Giants like Coca-Cola and other large corporations such as Tropicana, Lights Pasco, and Donald Duck support the Citrus Industrial Council, an agency to advise them on labor and harvesting practices. Its executive director, Clark M. Gieslin, explained how citrus workers are paid.
Well, Mr. Gieslin, would a weekly wage system be impossible in the citrus industry?
We have an average wage in the industry now of $2.50 an hour, which is approximately $1.20 an hour higher than the national farm labor average.
Mr. Gieslin, is it true that a husband working in the groves alone cannot make a living without the help of his wife and sometimes his children?
I would have to examine the particular case involved, but it could very well be, and we do find this in quite a bit of frequency in our recruitment, that there are many people who are just not adaptable to picking citrus, climbing a ladder and handling a bag, just the hard, arduous work day in and day out.
We keep hearing, Mr. Gieslin, that the citrus picker really has no desire to work 6 or 7 days a week over a period of time.
There are a certain percentage of pickers in the industry who will work at every opportunity that's offered to them. We offer generally, as an average, between 40 and 48 hours of work a week. The average number of days that the picker works is about 3.5, his hours per day run about 6.1. Now, this is all averages. This means the worker who goes out there and doesn't pick a box opposed to the worker who will pick 100 boxes in a day.
According to these figures, the average worker earns a yearly salary well below $2,000. Unless he has help from his wife and children, he is earning less than half of what the United States government defines as the poverty level. And the Citrus Industrial Council tells us 80% of the migrants working in the groves earn even less than this. These are just the statistics, numbers which must be translated into human beings who work when work is available, but fall farther and farther behind, as Ernest Jarvis, who works in the orange groves, explains.
Do you ever manage to save any money? Do you ever find yourself coming out ahead?
No, there are mighty few times I've found myself coming out ahead. I surrender them here and there. If I was ahead, I wouldn't. I'm behind.
You owe money.
I owe money. I owe my landlady money and I owe my boss man money right now. I ain't been able to pay my boss man for the last 4 weeks, which that he, the little work I do, he let me keep some money to pay my board bill and stuff like that. And he says, when we get to working good, then you can pay me something.
Since you're not able to save any money, do you ever worry about, say, 10 years from now or 15 years from now?
All the time. Not only then, I worry about the present now.
What do you think?
Well, I think that I need more work or better something. I need more of something to have something to go on.
Do you have any money coming to you when you're, say, 60 or 65?
Well, accordingly, they says that they would pay this here, pay Social Security or something like that. When you get 65, that I'd probably be able to draw it. But I don't know whether that would be enough for you to have probably be living by the same old meal now.
How old are you now, Mr. Jarvis?
Me, I am 39.
You're 39 years old.
39 years old.
Ernest Jarvis may never be faced with the problem of collecting Social Security. The United States Public Health Service estimates that while you and I may live until the age of 70, the life expectancy for a migrant worker in America is 49 years. All of us, even newsmen, dislike facing the unpleasant. We want to turn away, avoid looking and asking those painful questions, and getting the even more painful answers. But after careful consideration, the seriousness of this subject compelled us to intrude upon the privacy of some of these people. We felt it necessary to include these interviews in our broadcast, so we would all be forced to face the sad reality of these people's lives. We talked to Mr. and Mrs. Aubrey Gay. It was painful for us. It will probably be painful for you.
Mr. Gay, do you stay here during the summer?
Yes.
Why is that?
Well, the reason I stay is because if you go near to Michigan, you go up on work time and get back, you still haven't accomplished anything. Spend what you make going, spend what you make coming back.
Mrs. Gay, what do you think will happen to your children when they grow up?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think they'll work in the fields like you?
If they're still farming, they probably will.
Is that what you'd like for them to do?
No.
Do all of your children have enough clothes?
Not all of them. They got enough they can make out with.
They all have shoes?
Yes.
Do you ever have to go around and ask anybody, ask any of your friends or relatives for help?
Yes.
What kind of help?
Well, I didn't have the money and had to have milk and borrow money, stuff like that.
What does it feel like as a mother not to be able to give your children the food that you think they should have?
It was pretty bad.
When they go off to school, do
they get a free meal in school?
Two of them does. He can't stand no more talking.
Okay. We concentrated on conditions in Florida, which officially describes the migrants as, quote, the most economically and socially deprived segment of population in the United States, end quote. We could have made this film in any number of other states, but we chose Florida because it depends on the migrants, and for more and more of them, Florida is now home. NBC News invited the governor of Florida, Claude Kirk, to discuss these problems with us, but unfortunately, Governor Kirk declined. The responsibility goes beyond Florida and other states that depend on migrant labor. Beyond even large farmers, big business, organized labor, and federal agencies. To say that no programs have been instituted to help the migrants would be misleading. But it is our observation that recent reforms have had little substantial effect on the conditions of their lives. It should be the responsibility of all Americans to see that no American is deprived of the quality of life that the rest of us take for granted. It has been 10 years since Edward R. Murrow made Harvest of Shame. We hope that no one will need to make a film about migrants 10 years from now.